Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, an exclusive interview with the U.S.'s Ambassador for Religious Freedom as she headed off to participate at the Day for Peace in Assisi. And 2,000 years of Christianity in India. We speak with the head of India's Syro-Malabar Church on the challenges and achievements of this Catholic Eastern Rite. Participating in the Day for Peace in Assisi this past Thursday, the United States' Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom. Ambassador Susan Johnson Cook is an ordained Baptist minister whose new role makes her a principal advisor on religious liberty to the U.S. President and Secretary of State. She came into Vatican Radio studios before heading up to Assisi to tell us more about her job and her observer capacity at the one-day event. Well, so I'd like to start by asking you, what is an ambassador at large for international religious freedom?
Thanks for the question. First of all, I'm so honored to have been appointed by President Barack Obama and Secretary Hillary Rodham Clinton, and I bring greetings from them today. It is the principal advisor to the Secretary and the President of the United States on international religious freedom. There are over 198 countries that we are responsible for and to, and we do an annual report over these 198 countries as to how they are doing with religious freedom. So my job is to promote religious freedom and to monitor it where it's persecution going on around the world. So our main tools are this religious freedom report that's annual, certainly diplomacy, which is why I'm here in Rome and around the world, public diplomacy within the United States, educating and informing those who are in civil society, NGOs, faith leaders about religious freedom activity that's international. And then we also have a grant program that helps promote religious freedom in underserved areas.
Well, now you're here in Rome.
Yes.
We're talking ahead of the meeting in Assisi with the world's religious leaders.
Yes.
With many from coming around the world to that important encounter to pray and to reflect on peace. Now, they're probably not going to be expecting to talk about religious freedom at such an event. So what are you going to be taking with you to Assisi?
Well, first of all, on a personal note, my oldest son was born on the day of Assisi. So, you know, it's always wonderful. But I'm here for a week. The day of Assisi, promotes international freedom and dignity and justice. And so we are partners with the Vatican and with the Pope and with the world in terms of promoting those issues. I'm here for a week-long series of dialogues with interlocutors and actors who promote religious freedom. We have common goals and shared goals in terms of freedom for every human being, which is a fundamental human right. I'll be going tomorrow as an observer, but I also interface with a lot of the faith leaders who are coming from all over the world. And so many of the countries that I will go to, many of the ambassadors who are in Washington, I sit with regarding their issues of religious freedom. So tomorrow is a day to certainly respect what will happen there, so I'll be an observer. But the rest of the week will be opportunities to dialogue with those who have come for this celebration. You know, we have found where nations have religious freedom, there's more stability. And so we want to make sure that peace and freedom are values that we want to partner with the Vatican. And so I'm here, and it's an exciting time. And then to work with my colleague, Ambassador Diaz, who is the United States Ambassador to the Holy See.
Well, now your country, my country as well,
yes,
is at the heart of what is widely seen as a religiously motivated attack on September 11th, 2001. That was about 10 years ago.
It was a decade ago.
Now, after that fateful day, Pope John Paul II called the world's religious to Assisi to pray for peace and to reject the use of the name of God as a reason for conflict or violence. But can an event like Assisi actually be effective in in bringing about world peace, among religions.
Well, let me say yes to the latter part of your question, but the former part of your question, I was on the front lines of 9/11, which was really where my passion was ignited to be the ambassador for international religious freedom. I was at that time a police chaplain for the New York City Police Department, and so I was on the front lines of what was labeled Ground Zero.
Now, you were or are, correct me, you're a Baptist pastor.
I am a Baptist pastor by ordination, a Presbyterian by confirmation, but now an ambassador for everyone who wants to believe or not believe around the world. And so it's cross ethnicity, cross religious lines. I represent every believer in the world. But at that particular time, I was on the front lines. And so I believe that's what really ignited my passion to serve in this post, because what happened post 9/11 was that interfaith dialogue began on a very large scale, not only in New York, but around the world. And I think Assisi represents the continuation of that. It's not just prayer, but it also is time for interfaith dialogue. You know, religion is at the center of everything that we do, at the center of human life. More than 85% of the world believes in a being larger than him or herself. And so what is exciting about the strategic dialogue and about the Day of Assisi is that we're not ignoring religion. And it's a chance for religion and government to talk. Not that either loses their identity, but it says, where can we find common ground? Because it does impact and influence the lives of people. So where people are free to believe, as we said, it minimizes terrorism and extremism. And it allows people to sit at the table together and look for common ground. That's what Assisi represents. You know, when you're talking about peace, you're looking for places that we are in common ground. This morning, I was able to go to the Assisi prayer service that the Pope led. You know, there were at least 12 readings from 12 different nations, 12 different languages, and we were in one common place, you know, e pluribus unum. You know, there were many, but we are one. And I think that that's really the message that the world is really embracing and grasping now, that yes, there are differences in cultures and nationalities, but that those differences also have commonalities. And where can we find the common ground? As an ambassador, you know, that I'm a bridge builder. I'm looking for common ground. I'm looking for places where there are pragmatic openings. And so there are nations that may not be excelling in religious freedom, but it allows me to have an opening to sit down and say, where can we begin to promote? Because we're very concerned about religious minorities all over the world. Where can we begin to make some small steps that will then become bigger steps so that every human being has the right to believe or not believe what their choice is, and to have it as their choice and not mandated that they must believe a certain way because they're in a certain place. So, you know, it's a very exciting time, and Assisi just affirms and reaffirms that people are coming from all over. You know, some are called pilgrims, some are called by other names, but people are coming from all over saying, yes, we look different, we have different cultures, we speak differently, but there is one language of humanity, and that's the language of peace and freedom and dignity, and that's where we share.
What you were just saying earlier brings me to another point. Now, the State Department has designated 8 countries as countries of particular concern, which engage in or tolerate particularly severe violations of religious freedom. Now, those countries...
And egregious acts, certainly, yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. And those countries include some U.S. trading or strategic partners like China and Saudi Arabia. So that could seem contradictory to some people who would like to see the United States apply more pressure on these countries to ensure greater religious freedom.
Well, you know, My role, and that's why it's so important to understand, my mandate is to look at religious freedom in those countries. You know, every country is very complex. There are economic discussions going on. There are all kinds of political discussions going on. And those are for the White House and the president and the secretary to weigh in on. My mandate is to look at the religious freedom aspects of those countries and to follow the guidance, both of the secretary and the president, as I go to those countries. And so, yeah, there are countries of particular concern that are announced, and they can be appointed at any time or designated at any time. Our secretary just redesignated these 8 countries about a month ago, and it was the 2010 International Religious Freedom Report. Now that I'm on board, there will be a 2011 International Religious Freedom Report that will be announced in the spring. And there may be other countries. But what we hope will happen before other countries are either designated is that we also give countries an opportunity to come off the list, number one. And so helping people look at ways that they can do that. And then there are other countries, certainly, that we wouldn't call them of concern, but of particular interest that also may be placed on the list. And so I work, you know, I'm mandated by Congress. I work also with the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, or USERF. And so there are many voices that are looking also at religious freedom aspects. The secretary weighs all of the advice that's given to her, and the secretary, who is mandated by the president or given the authority by the president, will make her decision in terms of which countries for those particular violations or egregious acts of violence should be designated. So they can be designated at any time.
Okay. Well, in the Arab Spring uprisings that we've seen in the Middle East and North Africa, Christians joined Muslims in calling for freedom and democracy in those countries. But in some nations, particularly Egypt, we've seen an increase in violence against Christians. How concerned are you about that development?
Well, the United States is very concerned about all development. The Arab Spring certainly has called attention to the entire world that was going on. But there were, at the beginning of the Arab Spring, even in Egypt, Christians and Muslims who stood together and called for unity and for tolerance. So, you know, it's certainly a challenging time, but it also is a pragmatic opening time, particularly as countries are becoming more and more pro-democratic, for the United States to begin to have more dialogue, particularly in the area of religious freedom and the other areas that you shared about as well. But what we're also hoping to do is that in between these times is to also raise promising practices, because there are other places that mainstream religions have stood side by side. Liberia, for example, that's, you know, headed by President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. It was the women whose voices emerged. There were Muslim and Christian women who said, enough already. We have, you know, in the violence, in the religious discrimination, and the women have led the movement for peace in that place. So even one of the women, is along with Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, is now going to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. So I think that there are models, you know, around the world where it does work. And I think the Arab Spring is looking at all models in terms of what there are emerging voices in the Arab Spring that are coming forth, and many of them are religious leaders. So we are concerned about abuse and intolerance and, you know, what's happening with not only Coptic Christians, but other religious minorities around the world. And that is my task, to certainly promote religious freedom for all believers around the world.
We saw the Islamists win the recent elections in Tunisia, where the Arab Spring began. Is there any concern in the Obama administration about a swing to a more fundamentalist Islam in countries like Tunisia?
Well, we certainly will. You know, it's very recent, as we know. And so, you know, I don't have guidance on that at this particular time. But there's concern wherever there is persecution going on and egregious acts of violence. And as given guidance, you know, if that's one of the countries that I am to visit, then the secretary and the president will let me know. But beyond that, I can't speak for the administration, because we've not had a chance to, certainly since the elections, have that dialogue.
Christians in Pakistan have been particularly tried by the majority Muslim country's anti-blasphemy laws, to the extent that even a local governor was killed for attempting, or at least calling for an amendment of that law. How would you like to see that situation evolve?
Well, you know, first, I want to express and continue to express my condolences to the Taseer family. Governor Taseer was killed. Right after that, Minister Bhatti was also assassinated, who was the religious freedom minister. And so our condolences were expressed. The State Department and the president certainly have been very supportive of their families, the survivors, you know, after that. You know, blasphemy laws certainly concern us, and it is my hope to actually visit Pakistan. But what they have done in terms of advancing is certainly they've have now a ministry of Harmony Day, and they're trying to work towards at least some efforts to reverse some of the blasphemy and discrimination laws. What we are very excited about is what we call Resolution 1618, which was a consensus reached by the OIC in Geneva last March, and I was able to present in June in Geneva, and then in July went with Secretary Clinton to Istanbul. What Resolution 1618 is to combat discrimination and intolerance around the world, and what the Secretary has asked me to provide provide leadership for is the next stage of the implementation, which is now we're going to host an experts panel in Washington in December. We have the dates from the 12th through the 14th, and the counterparts in the Department of Justice and also the Department of Homeland Security will come, and we'll look at ways that governments can begin to implement tolerance and anti-discrimination behavior. And so it's, you know, each step allows for opportunities for new steps to be taken, which will hopefully one day we won't have this issue. Right now, unfortunately, my job will never be obsolete because there is so much going on in the world. But we have to begin to have small change and lift up places where there has been positive change, like Liberia and other countries, and begin to show what modeling it looks like so that others might follow. The other exciting thing is that there are other nations who have seen our Office of International Religious Freedom and who are considering opening their own International Religious Freedom offices as well. So I think in 2012 and beyond, you're going to hear some exciting news because we have tried to model what it can look like. And because of our probing, because of our pragmatic openings, because of my visits and my predecessors and the secretary and the president's commitment, people are taking religious freedom seriously. That's why we're here for Assisi, because it's a day that's promoting peace, tolerance, dignity, human rights around the world. And so there's a songwriter that says, "Let there be peace on earth and let it begin with me." If I can be a player in this peace on this day of Assisi and this pilgrimage to Assisi, then that is a wonderful, wonderful testament to be left.
And a very warm thanks there to Ambassador Susan Johnson Cook, the U.S.'s Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom. It's one of the Catholic Church's Eastern rites. And no, it's not just found in the East. In the age of international travel and migration, you'll find a Syro-Malabar church just about anywhere, even perhaps just down the street. Well, originally founded by St. Thomas himself some 2,000 years ago in his travels to India, the Syro-Malabar church today counts some 4 million Catholics around the globe. As a Latin Rite Catholic who doesn't know much about this Eastern Rite, the second biggest in the Catholic Church, I asked the major archbishop of the Syro-Malabar Church, Archbishop Mar George Allancherry, to help me fill in the gaps.
But we were very much Latinized in our liturgy, in our church administration and so on, for about 4 centuries, maybe 3.5 centuries.
The Archbishop explains that the Syro-Malabar Church is one of 3 Catholic churches in India, the Latin Rite, and the other native Syro-Malankara Rite. During the early colonial times, missionaries introduced the Latin Rite into the country, and Archbishop Allancherry says his Syro-Malabar Church's rites have maintained a mix of Latin and Eastern traditions.
Because of this Latinization, now in our church, we do not have what we call a pure Syro-Malabar liturgy. Everything is rather mixed with Latin style also. To unite all the 3 churches, individual churches, we have what we call a Conference of the Catholic Bishops of India, CBCI. And by the efforts of this conference, there is a communion and also collegiality, cooperation in the missionary and other activities of the church. This is the conference that guides. Mm-hmm. And to tell the truth, there is a very fine mutual understanding and functioning. Of course, now and then there may be differences of opinion and a little way of misunderstanding and so on, which we will discuss and settle if we go on in full cooperation.
In a big change from the past, where the major archbishop was appointed by the Pope in Rome, Archbishop Allancherry is the first Syro-Malabar church leader to be elected by a synod of bishops. The event was an important milestone for the Syro-Malabar church, which Pope John Paul II raised to sui juris, or autonomous status in communion with the church, in 1992.
We were always requesting from the Apostolic See a recognition of an individual church for us. That is called a church sui juris. And we got it in 1998. But because of the Latinization of which I spoke earlier, there were questions of disunity in our church regarding the liturgy and many other points regarding the traditions. And in order to unify us more and more, the Apostolic See was very careful. And although they gave us the major archiepiscopal status, they were holding certain of the provisions reserved to the Holy See, for example, liturgy and church administration. And then gradually, the liturgy was given to us and also the church administration was given to us. The two first major archbishops in the beginning did not have it, but the second one towards the end had all the privileges restored for our church. But regarding this point of election of the major archbishop, it was exercised for the first time in my case. So that is the speciality. It is true that we have thereby come to the full experience of the sui juris church. The individuality of the or the identity of this church is fully established. And by this election, our Synod of Bishops has expressed that the church has come of age and that the church can manage its own affairs.
My husband comes from an Eastern Rite himself. We married in the Latin Rite. Our kids have had been baptized or received confirmation in one or the other. Of course, they're both beautiful in their own ways. But while we've taken this situation as being normal, it does pose challenges to some of the faithful who would like to keep alive the Eastern rites, the Eastern traditions. So what sort of challenges do you, as head of the Syro-Malabar Church in all of the world, what sort of challenges do you confront every day?
You see, the Syro-Malabar Church do feel as a whole that we have a heritage of faith and practice of faith right from the time of St. Thomas.
Which goes back 2,000 years.
Yeah. And we have a liturgical celebration which is a really valuable exercise of the faith we have. Then our way of catechesis in the church, catechesis which we are systematically giving to our students, our children and youth. And we have our own family prayer and also the prayer units, etc. And the participation of the laity in the administration of the church, which is not that really powerful in the Latin tradition. And all these unique traditions we want to keep. And our people also, wherever they go, they want to keep. So because of that, if they do not get this facility, tensions are created. And there is some misunderstanding also caused between the Latin bishops or Latin authorities and then with the communities of our diaspora church. And that conflict is there.
Well, in fact, in speaking to you, Pope Benedict encouraged what he called the essential need for cooperation with Catholic bishops and pastors of other rites. Mm. So you do think that there is need for more cooperation?
You see, the cooperation is always from either side. And there should be understanding from either side. Mutual understanding, mutual dialogue will surely improve the situation. But actually, the question from the part of the Latin bishops is that they always think about a jurisdiction which is territorial. They think that a territory is given to them and nobody else has any right to do things there. All should be done through them. But according to our traditions, things can be done only by our priests and bishops. This is the real problem. And there is nothing impeding the Apostolic See to entrust us this work. Mm. Because every church has to grow on it in its own way.
This whole issue was brought up at the Synod of Bishops for the Middle East, where there are many Eastern rites, Catholic rites. Do you expect that that's going to be treated in some way in the post-synodal document which is being worked on now?
I hope so. But the church has to address that problem because the universal church is a communion of individual churches. Even though some of the individual oriental churches are very small communities, we have to protect them and we have to cherish their heritage and keep them in the universal church. And it is a task of the Latin bishops and churches to protect it. And there are many churches who understand it and act accordingly. For example, in the United States, all the Oriental rites have their own freedom and they work in full collaboration with the other bishops. Australian bishops are also very open to it. But in some other countries, I don't know why, they are not very open to this question. Church has to get open. The Ukrainian church and the Syro-Malabar church are the most numerous churches among the Orientals. We have 4 million Catholics. I think they have a little more, 4.5 million Catholics all over the world. And these churches, with their heritage of faith and practice of Christian life, can very well strengthen the universal church. So it is up to us to be open one to another. Holy Father is not simply advising us alone to cooperate. He is advising the universal church that there should be mutual cooperation. That is my understanding.
There is an Indian priest named Father Joseph who celebrates Mass at my church on Sundays here in Rome. Here, of course, in Europe, we see a major crisis in vocations and all elsewhere around the world as well. Now, the Pope, when he spoke to you, he praised your work in fostering vocations in your dioceses. Why do you think we've seen more vocational success in India, for example, in your church, than elsewhere in the world?
Simply because of the practice of faith in our church. These are the elements which I mentioned, some of which are very much lacking in the Latin church, and which gives rise to the fall or decline in vocations. We are an official church in many countries, and the distance between the priest and the bishop and the people is very wide. See, we are not a community creating the real church of the communion of the faithful together with priests and bishops. It is not a question of authority that we have to exercise. What we have to do is a diaconia, a service in the community. And if there are more and more intake from either part, then the church will come to the true nature. In our church, I don't say it is achievement by us who are presently now. That is a tradition that come up which we want to keep. And this is precisely what gives rise to vocations. You see, where our communities were recognized and dioceses were given, we have now vocations. For example, some 25 years back, there was a diocese given in Kalyan near Bombay. Now we get vocations from there. And the Syro-Malabar communities which are elsewhere, which are not recognized with our own bishops or exarchs, we do not get vocations because they go in the Latin way. And
so we're seeing Indian priests come here to the heart of Christendom.
Yeah. We are ready to do that. Yes. But at the same time, give us the freedom to develop on our own way. And that is what is needed. The richness of the heritage of the St. Thomas Christians all over the world shall not be caused to decline. It has to be fostered, and that is the function, the responsibility of the Universal Church. I hope the Holy Father will do that.
The Major Archbishop of the Syro-Malabar Church, Archbishop Mar George Allen Cherry. A very warm thanks there to him. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.